Inside Education, the weekly education programme on 103.2 Dublin City FM. I'm Sean Delaney, and you can listen to or download hundreds of podcasts of previous editions of Inside Education from seandelaney.com/podcasts. On last week's programme, I brought you the first part of my interview with Professor Kathy Short from the University of Arizona. Kathy directs Worlds of Words, which aims to build bridges across global cultures through children's literature. She has co-authored many books, including Critical Content Analysis of Children's and Young Adult Literature and Teaching Globally, Reading the World Through Literature. Professor Short was in Ireland to address the symposium on inquiry-based learning organised by the Marino Institute of Education to mark the launch of a new master's degree in inquiry-based learning being offered in the Marino Institute of Education. Last week, Kathy talked about inquiry as a stance in education, how teachers can nurture inquiry among children, and she brought us through the inquiry cycle. In the second part of our interview, we talked more about her work in language teaching, but we got into that area when I asked Kathy how she first became interested in inquiry-based learning.
Part of it, I think, is that I am a person that just inquires. I mean, like, I'm interested in everything, and I drive people crazy because I want to know, why is this? What happened here? But the other is that because of my background in children's literature, I've always been interested in dialogue and really thinking about how do you engage kids in really thoughtful talk about books, not just, you know, it was a cute book or, you know, I didn't like this character, but how do you really engage kids to think critically? And that led me into inquiry because what I described earlier in terms of realizing that I shouldn't be the one asking questions, that even when they're open-ended questions, I'm directing what the kids should think about. And it was much more productive for kids to find their own issues. And then from that, then that started making me feel really uncomfortable about the way that I was teaching content. Because before, it seemed like an ideal that was unrealizable, that the kids would find these, you know, their questions and tensions and be able to pursue those, that seemed to me like it was something that could only happen occasionally. And once I was able to do that with literature discussion, I realized, no, the problem was me. And it was how I was teaching. It wasn't that it wasn't possible.
And you've mentioned there you're interested in literature and teaching literature. The Worlds of Words program, you're actively involved in that. What is the Worlds of Words program?
Right, so it's an initiative that I established, and it's a center where our focus is on the use of literature to build international, intercultural understanding. So it's a physical collection of global literature. We have 40,000 books that are books set in all different global settings. Our particular focus are books that are published and distributed in the United States because I'm trying to really influence American teachers as well as teachers in international schools because I've worked with so many international schools. But they're all books that are set in global settings. And then we have lots of different outreach programs, things that we're doing with schools in our area. But we also have a website. And what we've done is to make available all kinds of resources that grew out of the questions and tensions that teachers were feeling. So one of the things teachers said to me is when I pick up a global book, a book set in another cultural setting, I don't know if it's authentic or not, you know, because I'm not from that global culture. So we established a journal called WOW Review, which is reviews of global literature, children's and adolescent literature, looking particularly at their authenticity. And then there, teachers talked about, I don't know how to use the books with children, because you can use a piece of global literature and establish a stereotype rather than international understanding. And so we published a journal called WOW Stories, which is vignettes, stories from classroom teachers about how they're using books with children. And then we also have a database that teachers can access to search for books. If you're a first grade teacher, what are books that are about family, but set in all different cultural settings, you know, what are some possible titles? So we've just provided this huge range of resources, and we have educators from over 180 countries who access the site and use those resources. And I have a whole group of educators that are part of our executive board who are managing all of our different initiatives, the online initiatives. So there's a whole group of us, a large, who are working. We also have a regular weekly blog, but it's not all coming from me. It's coming from a community that we've established ourselves, and we meet once a year. People come in from all over to think about where are we going to go next.
So the physical collection of 40,000 books, that's housed in Arizona, the University of Arizona.
Yes. We took an old computer center, and the computers we didn't need anymore because everybody has their own devices, and we converted it into just an absolutely beautiful center. It was completely renovated. It's a center that's very flexible in use, that we vary from having book fiestas with children on a Saturday morning to having a highly scholarly lecture, you know, on a Tuesday evening. So it's a center, it's open for anybody to come in and read, but it's also a center that hosts all kinds of programs and engagements, and convert from, you know, something that's very, very informal to something that's highly scholarly. The space is really, and the furniture that this is really movable and flexible.
And it's all cataloged in the online database.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And that includes things like the age group that stories are appropriate
right.
for.
Right. Yes.
That's quite a job of work. How long, when did you establish it?
Worlds of Words, we moved up just 4 years ago into the setting we're at now, but it was established in 2008.
In the mission statement of Worlds of Words, it states that children no longer have a decision about whether or not they will lead global lives, but they do need to decide how they will live in a global society. What kinds of decisions do children need to make?
So one of the things I think that is really critical when you live in a global society is whether you continue to look at the world and make judgments about the world through your lens, or whether you're open to the possibility of multiple lenses. So I find that very often children and adults don't realize that they have a cultural perspective. They see their perspective as the norm. This is the way the world is. And when I see you acting in a different way, you're different. And that's in a negative way of that, and seeing difference as a problem. And so a lot of that, how you live in the world, is do you choose to live in a world in which you're open-minded and recognize that there are multiple perspectives? Or do you choose to live in a world in which you see that there are multiple perspectives, but you judge each of them against yourself? And you look at those other perspectives as strange or weird, or you look at them and have pity. I'm sure glad I don't have to live that way. You look at them with a view of superiority. So there are lots of different views that and attitudes, and a lot of it relates to being aware of the way that you connect universally with all children, all peoples, but also what makes each cultural community unique and distinct, and is at the heart of understanding who they are. Being open to that, as well as stepping back from judgment. That's, to me, one of the major decisions that I think children are involved in making. Another is gaining knowledge. I mean, it's amazing to me as I teach courses and engage teachers, pre-service teachers, children, how little they know about the world and about major, major historical events and occurrences around the world that they've never heard about. You know, I talked about briefly today about, well, I mentioned that some of the kids ended up looking at the Japanese occupation of Korea, and I still remember in a graduate class on global literature, I'd introduced the book When My Name Was Kyoko, which is a Korean perspective on the Japanese occupation of Korea. And in that class was a graduate student, a doctoral student from Japan, and she did not know that Japan had occupied Korea because it's nowhere in their textbooks. I mean, it was a life-changing experience for her because she said, I always wondered why Korean international students were kind of standoffish to me, you know, kind of set me apart. And I didn't know what that separation was because it hadn't been no part of my education.
Yeah. You've written about a curriculum that is intercultural. What is a curriculum that is intercultural?
For me, I've identified, given the research that I've done, four components that need to cut across the year. They're not in every experience. But one is kids have to have some experiences where they're looking at their own culture. Because again, if they don't look at their own culture, it's hard for them to value another culture or to see another culture. They also need some experiences that are cross-cultural. And what I mean by that is, like that Korean study that I was talking about, where they look at another culture in great depth. Because if they're only looking at bits and pieces of many, many different cultures, they fail to understand that each culture has complexity and depth. So they need to have some in-depth studies of cultures that are not their own. They also need to do what I would call integrated studies. So I would argue that no matter what they're studying, there should be multiple global perspectives. So let's take that family example. That's a fairly common focus within first grade, is to do an in-depth study of family. They should be exploring families and books and literature set in multiple cultural perspectives. There should not just be family, Irish families, right? So that some of what they're doing are these integrated studies. And then I would say the fourth component is that they need to occasionally do in-depth global inquiries. And what I mean by that is inquiries into the major problems faced by our world, whether that's population or environment, poverty, human rights. And those problems are both local and global. So when we engaged in a study of hunger with kids in Tucson, we looked at the hunger in our own community as well as globally and tried to understand why hunger is occurring. And then based on that, what might be some steps we might take. But we spent the majority of our time understanding why. Part of a curriculum that's intercultural is that we're willing to take on and understand what's going on in the world in order to take action and make a difference. So I think curriculum inquiry, you have to understand culture. And you do that through looking at your own culture and looking in depth at other cultures. You have to understand perspective, and that's through these integrated studies. And you have to understand action and what it means to take action.
Another thing that strikes me, and you know, when you give that example of, say, the Japanese student who didn't know about the occupation of Korea, is how do you teach students at any level to go about not just sourcing reliable information, but even verifying it, because so much information, and especially information that's easily accessible, like online, you know, it's all coming from particular perspectives. And even if you go back and go for, you know, say, printed material, you know, that's a bit older or even that's contemporary, how do you get people to appreciate the perspectives, and that the perspectives are not always, and I'm using this term in inverted in quotation marks, truthful or balanced?
Right. So the part that I didn't describe on a curriculum that is intercultural is for me that there's a lens that lays over all that, which is a critical lens. So Paulo Freire's notion that we have to ask what is and really look closely at what actually exists in the world and question that reality and ask why it exists, and then to think about what if, what are the possibilities, and then take action. To me, that critical lens has to be across. So even when I'm looking at my own personal cultural identity, I have to question that identity, because there's always aspects of our own identities that are problematic. Right? And so in each of these, we're taking a critical lens of not just accepting it, but critiquing it and then asking what if, what are the possibilities? And so with everything we do, we're bringing in that critical lens. So for example, with the Korea study, you're right. We spent a lot of time with the kids when they started doing particularly their own investigations. We did some demonstrations with them, thinking about how do you look at what the source of that website is to say, what is the perspective this person is bringing? What is it that they're trying to persuade me? And teaching the kids some strategies. So we're bringing that critical lens to everything. And therefore, it becomes a much more natural lens for them to always bring on.
And if you think about the work of a teacher, then they don't have a subject called interculturalism. So how do they integrate the intercultural curriculum with the subject curriculum that we would all know, like social studies, English, right, language arts, and all those different subjects?
So a lot of it just is looking at what are the resources that I'm using within each of those lessons, and how can I bring in a little diversity. And sometimes it's thinking about, you know, if we're looking at habitats, can I bring in a habitat that is one that's going to introduce kids to another part of the world? If I'm thinking about in the U.S., there's a whole history focus around the Civil War, the U.S. Civil War. Well, that connects to the notion of conflict that is within, not where someone's invading you, but conflict that's within. Well, we can look at that notion of conflict within across the world. So it doesn't just the U.S. Civil War, but how is it that that conflict that is internal within a group of people, how has that been experienced in multiple places? So it's looking at the curriculum and saying, what's the potential here to globalize? And again, thinking about, is it bringing in a personal cultural connection? Is it bringing in another cross-cultural study? Is it simply bringing in a whole range of cultures? Or is it identifying a global issue that we can look at within that? Because conflict, for example, is a global issue. And so it would be easy to take that one, not just to study the U.S. Civil War, but to look at how that how conflict internally is a global issue. So it's not a new subject area. It's got to be woven through what is currently being studied. We did a study within Worlds of Words where we had some grants where over 3 years we supported different literacy communities across the U.S., just groups of teachers that said we want to look at how to make our curriculum more international, more global, using literature, and we gave them small grants, and then they wrote vignettes. And then out of that, we did a guide that's available on the Worlds of Words website, which shows what are all of the different ways that different schools from elementary through high school, that they worked at globalizing in their curriculum, making it more intercultural. And they went from very, very small things to using one new book to completely changing their curriculum. We came up with 10 different ways that teachers were going about finding a way to make their curriculum more intercultural. And our reason for that guide was to say there's one way to do this. And you need to look at this and think about which step would be the one that would make the most sense for you in your school. And the guide is very short, it's like 35 pages, but each one of them is connected through a web link to a vignette by the teachers from that group where they describe it in more depth. So you can see it actually at play, how it played out for them.
You serve, Kathy, on the committee that awards the Caldecott Medal. Yeah. For someone who's not heard of it, what is the Caldecott Medal?
So the Caldecott Medal would be the very top award in the United States for illustration. So we have two major awards. One is the Newbery and the other is the Caldecott. The Newbery is given to an author for the best written book, the most powerfully written.
For children.
For children. And the Caldecott and is given to for illustration. The word that's used actually in both the Newbery and the Caldecott is the most distinguished written book and the most distinguished illustration. So it is like, you know, the Academy Awards. It's the Oscar. The book that wins that award sells thousands and thousands and thousands of copies and never goes out of print. It's put in every library, and it's very closely guarded. So the discussions about the award, the whole process is you're completely under oath. You can't reveal any part of that discussion in terms of specific comments around books because it's, to be frank with you, it's tied to such prestige and such money that, you know, knowing that this book just barely lost out is not a good thing.
And are the criteria publicly available?
Yeah, the criteria, all of that is publicly available on the, it's American Library Association. But, you know, the news is released in a major press conference. We read books and have online discussions throughout the year. And then the actual selection is we're literally shut into a room with guards in front of the door for 3 days to go through a whole process of making the final decision of what will win the Caldecott and what will be anywhere from 3 to 5 honor books.
I mean, it must be tough because how many children's books are published in the States every year? roughly?
If you count every book, it's usually around 10,000.
So it's a tough job.
Oh yeah, it's an extremely tough job. Yes, and publishers nominate their books, so you just get boxes and boxes of books.
What's a typical working day like for you, Kathy?
I don't think there is one. One of the things that I love about being a university professor is that your life is so varied. So, you know, there are some days when, because I'm at a research university and I'm expected to do research as part of my job, it's not additional. And so for me, because my interest is curriculum, that means that I'm in a school. So there's usually, you know, one day where I'm out in a school working with a group of teachers thinking something through. And then there are some days when I'm at the university all day long and I'm meeting with doctoral students, talking with them about their dissertations. My teaching is all at night because I'm either teaching master's courses with teachers who are teaching during the day, or I'm working with doctoral students who are teaching undergrad courses during the day. So, you know, some days I'll have these very long days that I'll get home at 10 o'clock at night. And then some days I stay at home and I'm writing. And then there are times like this where I'm able to, you know, take a period of time and go and work with a group of teachers in another cultural community. And that always pushes me to consider factors that I haven't thought about before. And how is it being interpreted? And what are the tensions and challenges that people are meeting in this particular community? How does it differ from the ones that I've experienced in other places? So I don't have a regular day.
And you've said you conduct a lot of your research in schools. How do you go about conducting your research?
I find someone who wants to think together. So I have things that I'm really passionate about, and through the many interactions that I have with teachers, either in classes or in different kinds of professional learning experiences, I find someone who's sharing an interest. And sometimes it's a school, like the school I talked about today. That was a whole school project, and we were in doing a study group together every other week. You know, I was working in different classrooms each week. And sometimes it's an individual teacher where we're just working together on a particular literature discussions or a particular unit of inquiry, or what does it mean to take action in a way that's not charity. So there's something that's compelling. It's a question that's emerged, and I search for somebody who shares that interest so that we can develop that research together, versus my coming in and saying, I want to use your classroom to do this set of research. I look for somebody that I can think with.
Who or what inspires you?
Learners. So, I mean, I just find learning exciting and compelling. And so no matter whether I'm working with a doctoral student or I'm working with, you know, a graduate class or an undergraduate class, I'm working with children and teachers, when learning is happening and inquiry is happening, I'm just high. It's just exciting for me, and I just get passionate about it. So anytime I'm in an experience where learning is happening, I'm there.
Have you a favorite book or blog or writer about education?
There are particular theorists that have influenced me a great deal. So Paulo Freire, who, you know, is really his work around how to think critically. Louise Rosenblatt, who's really written about transaction and the ways in which readers need the opportunity to first make personal connections before they stand back and critique and look for evidence. She's had an incredible, and the role of literature in imagination and democracy. And democracy not in a government stance, but a democracy in terms of how we live with each other and attend to both the individual and the group. So there are particular theorists like that that I read over and over that are influencing me. It's hard for me in terms of an author, like a children's or young adult, because I read so many people. But I love the work of Sean Tan, who's Malaysian-Australian, because he uses his illustration and his stories. You can read them at so many different levels. You have a very superficial kind of fun story. And then when you start digging into that, you really realize that there's a lot of social commentary and a lot of critique of our world. So I love authors where every time you read it, you think something different.
How do you spell his name?
It's Shaun, S-H-A-U-N, Tan, T-A-N. Okay. He's an illustrator and author from Australia, but his background is his family emigrated from Malaysia.
If you could make one change to your current school and resources were not an issue, what change would you make?
Long-term professional learning for teachers. So I
is think that for university teachers or for
both?
Okay.
Because one of the things that I think that we often do, whether it's a public K-12 school or if it's a university, is that we teach in the way we were taught. And when we're offered some kind of professional learning, and to be frank with you, at the university, we really aren't offered professional learning, right? We're assumed that we know how to teach at the university. So any kind of professional learning would be good at the university. But it tends to be short term. Like, you know, here's a quick spritz of something, now go and do it. And I think that in order for us to really change our teaching and to teach, to build our capacities as teachers, again, whether we're university teachers or we're K-12 teachers, we need our own inquiry that's long term. And that takes place through action research, that takes place through dialogue groups, that takes place through bringing in experts who share, but then that isn't the end of it. Like something like today should be continuing through study groups, through courses, through, if it doesn't, then today was a waste of my time and a waste of everybody's time who came. It's gotta be long term. So that's the change I'd make, is because I think particularly K-12 schools have invested themselves in lots and lots of short-term quick fixes that cost a lot of money, and they don't last very long. And then you go to something else because they think the long-term is going to be too expensive and take too long, but they're investing just as much in the short-term stuff that doesn't end up doing anything. And universities, we simply aren't investing in professional learning.
A comment there from Kathy Short on the importance of ongoing professional development for all educators. If you'd like to listen back to Kathy Short's interview, you can find a link to it and almost 300 other programmes on seandelaney.com/podcasts. My own book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, published by Routledge, is available now from Hodges Figgis in Dublin and online bookstores. You can contact me by emailing insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.